For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
It's February the 7th. We are on page 552. And we are finishing up the discussion of Karban Mincha, of a flower offering, a meal offering. And the thing we left off with was Pasuk Gimel, verse 13, that says, V'chol Karban Minchascha b'melach timlach. All your Karban Minachos, all your meal offerings, have to have salt. V'lo sashpis melach b'ris elokecha, and do not hold back the salt of the covenant of your God, me'al minchasecha, from upon your mincha. So all the Minachos have to have salt. And then in addition to that, al kol karban cha takriv melach, on all your karbanos, you have to bring salt. So all of the karbanos need to have salt, the mincha in particular, but they all need to have salt. So we were going to discuss what is the significance of salt and its importance in the karbanos. Now, salt has some significant properties which were more significant prior to the age of refrigeration and freezing. And that is that salt preserves. Salt preserves. It can preserve meat and fish. It can preserve vegetables and fruits. Salt, either in the form of salt itself or as brine, as some sort of a juice, can serve to take care of, it cures things. It removes the liquid from something, which then makes that item last much longer.
Also help remove the blood also.
Okay, so that's another method. That's another thing that salt does, is it removes blood, which is a liquid. So it removes blood from the from meat, and we use that in order to kosher meat. Now, meat can be koshered really in two ways. One is through salting, and the other is through roasting. Roasting over an open flame will also get out the blood, or get out enough blood that it makes it okay to eat it. Even the roasting process is better when you add salt to the meat prior to the roasting process. But those are the two ways that meat can be koshered, with either roasting or salting. But salting is definitely the way that it is done. Salting enables the meat, after it is salted, to be prepared in any manner that you wish. If salt is not used, the only way that it can be prepared is through roasting. You can't boil the meat if you have not salted the meat. So, because salting, salt does both things. Salt it's really the same process. It pulls the liquid out of the item, which is what preserves it, and also how the blood comes out of it. We find that salt is considered to be something that is used as a covenant. So it's mentioned here, and it says, don't hold back the covenant of the salt of the covenant of Hashem. We also find, if you'll hold the place here on 552, and jump ahead to Parshas Korach. In Parshas Korach, we know that Korach tried to usurp the kahuna. He wanted to become the Kohen instead of Aaron. And after his rebellion was put down, then Hashem made an official covenant with Aaron to seal the fact that Aaron is the Kohen and no one else is the Kohen.
What page?
So it is on page... I was looking for it, that's why I didn't tell you.
Is that before?
I'm sorry?
Is that before?
No, it's later on. It's later on. Yeah, on page 834. So in this paragraph, we're not going to read the whole paragraph now, Mir Hashem, we'll get to it when we get to Parshas Korach, in a few years. So when we get there, So this paragraph is discussing the covenant and the various gifts that Aaron gets and the Kohanim get as part of the covenant. But in Pasuk Yud Tes, verse 19, it says, as a general rule, Kol Trumos HaKadoshim Asher Yarimu V'nei Yisrael HaShem, all of these various sanctified gifts or separations that the Jews will separate for Hashem, Nasati Lecha, I Hashem have given it to you, to Aaron. Now, as the Jews have to separate these things, the Trumos, and the various parts of the carbon, and the various parts of the dough, and things like that. So the Jews have to separate it, but then I, Hashem, have turned around and given it to you, to Aaron. So I've given it to you, ulevanecha, to your sons, velivnosecha, to your daughters, itcha, with you, lechak olam, as a statute forever. Beris melach olam hi lifnei Hashem. It is a covenant of salt forever. Between you, in front of Hashem, for you and for your children after you. So it is a covenant of salt. Now there's no salt over there in the covenant, but it's called the covenant of salt. So Rashi tells us, why does it say a covenant of salt? So I'm going to read the Rashi too. I'll read it to you in the Hebrew. I'll translate. Karas bris im Aaron, Hashem cut a covenant with Aaron. B'davar habari, with something that is in existence. Umiskayim, and it lasts. Umavri esacherim, and it causes other things to last. Salt lasts, and it causes other things to last. And then he goes on to say, bris melach, a covenant of salt, kibris hakrusa lamelach, like the covenant that has been cut with salt. Hashem has made a covenant with salt. What's that covenant? She'eno masriach, it doesn't rot. Salt can last forever. So Hashem has, so to speak, made a covenant with salt. In other words, He created something that lasts. It does not go bad. Right. So just as the salt doesn't go bad, so too this covenant with Aaron is set in stone. It will never go bad. It is a permanent covenant with Aaron. And salt, it itself lasts. It doesn't go bad. And it not only does it itself last, it also empowers other things to last. Salt can impart its property to other things. Now, the way that happens is by pulling out the liquid and curing it. But the fact is, what salt does is it can make things last, which means salt itself has a koach, it has a power that it lasts, and Hashem gave salt the property that it can make other things last also, which is an amazing thing, right? Water flows. It doesn't make, it can't make you and me flow. You can't put water on meat and make the meat. It can carry the meat with it, but it won't turn the meat into liquid, right? Salt will make the meat similar to salt, in that it will last. Mm-hmm. It's a power.
If you add back water to it, you give it back life.
Yeah, that's true too.
I did that with cod fish. I remember the cod was salted.
Yeah.
Then you let it was hard boiled.
Right.
Hard. Then you let it soak in water.
And then it comes back. Yeah.
Of course, once the salt draws out the blood from the meat.
Yeah.
The salt itself is spoiled. Can't use that.
Well, you mean it used up its yeah, potency. Yeah, salt can use up its ability to affect other things.
Yeah, right.
That's true.
So what is its bracha that Hashem gave that salt?
Okay, so that's what salt does. And therefore, Hashem says to Aaron, my bris with you, my covenant with you is like salt. It's a salt covenant. Here, back on page 552, Hashem is saying that the karbonos have to have the salt of the covenant of Hashem. That's what it has to have. So what covenant are we talking about, the salt of the covenant of Hashem? What does that mean? So So Rashi here tells us that back in the beginning of creation, Hashem, as we know, separated the waters. There is the Mayim HaElyonim, the waters above. We don't know exactly what that means, the waters above. What waters is that talking about? It's unclear. And then there's the Mayim HaTachtonim, the waters below. That's the waters down here in this world. So when Hashem separated the waters down here were getting a raw deal. They were getting down here instead of upstairs. Upstairs is much better than down here. If you have a choice, you want to be upstairs, not down here. So the waters down here needed to be placated, so to speak. Obviously, water does not have any feelings. Water does not have any choices. But the Gemara is, the Medrash is speaking in a manner that we can understand that Hashem, so to speak, had to placate the water down here, had to give it something so that it would not be considered inferior. So Hashem did two things for the water down here. That it would be represented in the Beis HaMikdash, the most elevated place in this world. One is with the Nisuch HaMayim, with the water libations, which is only done on Sukkot. The whole year round, there is Nisuch HaYayin, there's wine libation. Water libations only over Sukkot, the 7 days of Sukkot. That's it. So that Nisuch HaMayim is the representation of the water in the Beis HaMikdash, in a karban. And there is other water in the Beis HaMikdash, of course, in the Kiyar, but as something that goes on the Mizbeach, on the altar, that's where water is represented. You see, it's inherently difficult to have a situation where the water would be on the Mizbeach, because the altar, what you do with things on the altar is you burn it. So water on the altar,
big singlish,
would be a problem. So when do we find water on the altar? Only in the libations. It doesn't go on the fire. It goes into a basin that goes down into the Mizbeach.
What does libation mean?
To pour. The pouring of the water. The pouring of the water. But the other representation of water on the Mizbeach in a karban is this salt. Because salt is considered to be something associated with water. Now, obviously, the ocean water being salty, we understand that there's salt with the water. Most salt that is found in the world is in a liquid state, meaning it's brine. There are brine springs. You find the salt with water. Now, there are some places where salt is mined, where you have solid chunks of salt, solid salt in different places in the world. But most of the salt is actually in the liquid state.
Like the Dead Sea.
Like the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is an extreme case.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So that is that there, the salt therefore is a representation of water. But it's not just because of that. It's not just because of the fact that salt is found predominantly with water. It's also because the property of salt is that it draws liquid to it. That is what salt does. It pulls liquid into it. It acts like a sponge, grabbing the liquid and pulling it. So if you coat something with salt, it will pull the liquid out of that item. So salt, you see, has a strong connection with water. And therefore, one of the ways that the water is represented on the Mizbeach is through salt. And it's a covenant of salt implies a permanence, something that doesn't change, something that lasts. Now, the fact of the matter is that this property of salt, that it lasts, is really something that is not that doesn't fit into the typical way that this world works. The primary difference between Olam Hazeh, this world, and either call it Olam Haba or call it the world of Ruchnius, the spiritual realm where the angels exist, The primary difference is that this world is the Olam Ha'asiya. It's the world of doing. And the next world is not. We know that in all ways, Olam Haba, the next world, is better than this world. It's a pleasurable place. There's no pain in Olam Haba. It's a wonderful place to be. We're very close to Hashem, closer than we could ever be in this world. The Olam Haba is a wonderful place. Olam Hazeh is full of pain and suffering and distance from Hashem. It's not a wonderful place. However, there is one advantage that this world has over the next world. And that is, in this world, you can change. You can improve. You can do better. Because this world is constantly changing. And the next world is stagnant. It is what it is. This world constantly changes. The more we have learned scientifically, the more this has been borne out. We know that we are made up, everything is made up of cells and atoms that are constantly moving, even if you can't discern it, but they are moving. But we don't even need scientific observations to prove this. We know that we are constantly changing. We are constantly aging. We know that everything is constantly changing. Every item we have is constantly aging. Things are changing. Things are moving. Things are nothing remains the same. And one of the processes that takes place constantly is decay and spoilage. That's a constant thing that happens in the world. Everything is constantly moving. Everything is constantly changing. Salt, being something that remains as a constant, is unusual for this world. Now, there are other things that have a consistency that is more permanent. Let's say a very hard stone. Very hard stone. There are softer stones and harder stones. But a very hard stone would be an example of something that's similar to salt in that it does change, but it's much more slowly. It appears at least to defy the change of this world. Generations can come and go, and that stone can still be the same stone. But the difference between stone and salt is that stone, it's true, it doesn't change, at least discernibly. It takes a very, very long time for there to be change in the stone. But it does not impart that property to other things. Salt has permanence, and it can impart that property to other things. That's what sets salt apart in it being different than everything else in this world. Everything else is changing. Salt doesn't change, at least not discernibly. You know, it may change over a long period of time, but it essentially is the same thing. And it can make others pick up a certain level of permanence. Not as permanent as the salt is, but it can make other things also have a permanence that shouldn't really be found in this world. In that way, salt resembles the spiritual realm. Salt resembles something that isn't from this world. Something that is from the spiritual realm. Something that is more stagnant, that is more permanent. So when Hashem is making a covenant with Aaron, and Hashem is saying, unlike everything else in this world, this will not change. I am not going to change this. Aaron is my Kohen, and that's it. The discussion is over. There's nothing else to talk about. That covenant is sealed in salt. Because there is no way it's going to change. It is. Don't bother discussing it. It is. It's almost like taking an element from the spiritual realm and injecting it into this world. And that covenant is sealed with salt. The karbanos that are representing our connection, or I should say the mizbech particularly, is our interface with the spiritual realm. Salt needs to be present because salt is that item in this world, in the physical world, that most resembles or most embodies the property of the spiritual world. Yeah.
Noach's wife
was going to ask the same thing.
Lot's wife.
Yeah,
good.
Is there any...
Good, that's a very, it's a very good question.
That's a good, right? That was my question.
Very good question. Yeah. I'm just going to close that door. Very excellent question.
That was my question. Yeah. After you asked yours, this Lot's wife was turned into salt, but she looked back at Sodom and Gomorrah.
Okay, okay.
And if salt has permanence...
Yeah, yeah. So let me address that in a moment, okay? Let me get back to that. That's a good question as well. Let me get to that. Before discussing that, let's just discuss the water down here, the water upstairs. Salt being present in most of the water down here, we can't drink that salt, which I'm going to tie into the issue of Lot's wife. But most of the water in the world is salty. There's salt in the water. That's the vast majority. 99% of water in the world is filled with salt. That means that the water that is down here does have in it an element that represents the spiritual realm. Meaning Hashem took the water and split it. There's the Mayim HaElyonim and went upstairs, whatever that means. The water down here gets salt in the water, which ties it to the next world. It speaks of permanence.
It speaks of Hashem's divine power.
Well, it speaks of permanence. I mean, salt is not Hashem, Chas V'Shalom, it speaks of permanence. Things that are permanent are next worldly, not this worldly. Now, all of that is very interesting, and it speaks to the positive elements of salt. But there is, when we talk about something that is unchanging and permanent, there's really two ways to express that, and I already used both words. There is the permanence. Permanence is a positive thing. When you hear the word permanent, you think solid, right? Eternal, solid, right. Strong. That's what you think about, right? There's another way to say it, which is stagnant. That's a negative. Everything else is changing. Everything else ebbs, flows, grows, waxes, wanes, right? There's a vibrancy to things that change. Something stagnant is dead. The Dead Sea is called the Dead Sea because it's full of salt and nothing lives there. Right. It's so salty that it has no life whatsoever, right? Because it's too salty. Mm-hmm. So salt in it's the same property. It's not a different property. It's the same exact property. In its permanence and the fact that it doesn't change has two things about it. It has two messages about it. One of those messages is a very strong positive message, that of permanence, of solidity. But it also has a very negative connotation, that is of death, of stagnation. Of something which cannot grow anymore. That also is what salt represents. Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt was salt means in that context means
dead, finished.
Yeah, finished, stagnation. Nothing. There's nothing. No benefit will come of it. It just is. It just there's no not not no better. It there's no hope for improvement. It just is. Why that should befall Lot's wife in particular is a good question. And it's something to think about. Mm-hmm. But the salt also represents that. So in the context we have it here, we're talking about the permanence of salt and therefore its connection to the next world and its presence on the Mizbeach, on the altar. The salt can also represent the end, that there is nothing further. It just is, and it's stagnant, and there's nothing more you can do. That's what it can also represent. And in like with everything in this world, you have two sides of a coin. We have the fact that water, for example, water is the polar opposite of salt in this sense. Water represents life, vibrancy, movement. Water's always moving. Water always flows. Water is the symbol of life.
It could be deadly too.
But it can be deadly and kill. The flood is how Hashem killed everything.
That's right.
The water, the world filled with water cannot sustain life, human life. can only sustain fish. There has to be no water. The water had to be pulled away from the dry land in order for human beings to exist, in order for this world to reach the fruition it needs to reach. The waters covering the land is a way of, it's a regression. That's a negative. So as much as water represents life, water can also represent death. Mm-hmm. There's two sides to it. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes with fire. Fire can represent it. We talk about his soul is on fire. Right? Fire is also speaks of life, of excitement, of being animated. Someone who is moving gets heated up. Their body heats up. There's a sense, if your person's cold on a cold day, you jump around, you move your body around, you get warm, right? There's the body, the warmth, the heat. There's a vibrancy in heat, and of course fire can provide that. And what fire does for food, etc., right? We know that that's what fire does. But at the same time, fire also represents complete destruction of everything that there is. So most things, that probably everything in this world, has two sides to it. There's always two sides of the coin. So salt, in its very nature of its permanence, also represents something very negative, and that's stagnation. So here, in this sense that we're using it on the Mizbeach, so there it is representing the permanence, that solid strength that is the covenant of Hashem. And when we interface with Hashem using the Mizbeach, the salt must be present to represent that quality. Now, it is a curiosity that it is emphasized here with the Menachos, and only as almost like an afterthought. It's thrown in to also be important for all other karbanos, as it says in the pasuk. You should put salt on all of your menachos, and don't hold back salt from your mincha. And then it says, on all your karbanos you should put salt. So it's true, all the karbanos needed to have salt. But it seems that the menachos were more, it was more important. There was a more significance of the salt in the karban mincha. And therefore, that is where the Torah chooses to talk about salt and the karbanos, and the rest of the karbanos are thrown in, as I said, almost as an afterthought, as a secondary thing. So that is a curiosity. It may be because of the fact, as we learned the past couple of weeks, that the mincha is a poor person's offering. And it could be that specifically where Hashem wants to send home this lesson, to hit home this lesson, that the karbanos represent a connection with the next world, and it doesn't matter whether it's a wealthy karban or if it's a poor karban, it doesn't make a difference. Either way, one is connecting. It could be that's why Hashem specifically wants it emphasized here, but there's probably greater depth to that. And perhaps in the future we'll have other reasons that we'll talk about. Now, we have one more paragraph about the Karban Mincha. We talked about many of the Karbanos Mincha. We talked about the fact that the Karban Mincha is always matzah and not chametz, with the exception of the Shtei HaLechem, the two loaves that were brought on Shavuos. We talked about that last week. And now we talk about the prelude to the Shtei HaLechem. And that is perhaps the most famous Karban Mincha of them all, and that's the Karban HaOmer. Okay. So here, the Torah mentions the Karban HaOmer. It's mentioned in a little bit of a different language than you would expect, as in, it doesn't say Karban HaOmer over here. Vim takriv minchas bikurim laHashem. I'm sorry, Pasuk Yudal, verse 14. Vim takriv karban minchas bikurim laHashem. So now this is translated as when you bring a meal offering of the first grain to Hashem. So the word bikurim is used over here, but we don't mean the bikurim that are brought on Shavuos, which was mentioned back in Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12. It was mentioned. Actually, I'm sorry. We really the Bikurim were not mentioned over there. They'll be mentioned later on. Back in Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, it says you can't have any leaven nor any sweetness, any honey of the fruit honey. You can't have. And then the Torah says you could have leaven in the Shtei HaLechem, the two loaves that are brought on Shavuos. It doesn't tell you, well, what about the sweetness of fruit? That is in the Bikurim that are brought on Shavuos, which will be discussed later in the Torah. Here, when it says Bikurim, the word Bikurim doesn't mean fruit, even though when we say Bikurim, we are referring to fruit, but it doesn't mean fruit. The word Bikurim comes from the word Bechar, firstborn, first fruit, first offering. That's what the word Bikurim means. So when you bring a Karban Mincha, which is Bikurim, the very first Karban Mincha brought of the season. So as I mentioned to you last week, the Karban Shtei HaLechem, the two loaves, was on Shavuos, was the represented the time when now new grain for this year could be brought to the Beis HaMikdash. But the Karban HaOmer, which was brought on Pesach, that represented the fact that everywhere else except the Beis HaMikdash, meaning all the rest of the Jewish people, from that point on, could eat the new grain. That's the Karban HaOmer. Therefore, it's also called the Karban Minchas Bikurim. It's a first offering, a first grain offering, because the Karban HaOmer was brought from the first grain. The Karban HaOmer was brought from barley, not from wheat. That is a departure from most Karbanos Mincha. Almost all of the Karbanos Mincha had to be wheat. But the Karban HaOmer was barley. There's another one that's also barley. Anybody know the other Karban HaOmer, that's barley? The Karban Mincha that the Sota brings is barley. Yeah. We'll learn about that. Mein Sashem, we get the Parshas Naso. But here, this is a Karban Seor. We'll see it. It'll say it in the Pasuk itself. We'll read it in a moment. So this is the Karban HaOmer, and this would permit the use of the new grain. It was the first harvest. The Beis HaMikdash, the Kohanim, would identify a field that was harvest that was ripening more quickly than all other fields. There were particular areas of Eretz Yisrael where it was known that the fields would ripen more quickly. And that barley was watched, it was guarded, and it would be harvested specifically for the Karban HaOmer. Now, there is a difficulty with the Karban HaOmer that you don't find with any other Karban Mincha. A Karban Mincha is brought from flour. You take the wheat, it's ground into flour, and that's where the Karban is brought from. The wheat that you use, since it's already ground into flour, was not grown recently. Wheat, in order for it to be ground into flour, first has to dry out. As long as wheat is still moist, then it cannot be ground into flour. It has to dry before that can happen. And typically it dries for several months in the sun. In Israel, they have a rainy season and a dry season. The dry season, there is no risk of rain. So the wheat sits out in the field and it dries. Then it's taken into the threshing floor, and eventually it is ground into flour. And that can be brought as a karban. But the Karban HaOmer, the barley, had to be harvested the night before the barley was offered as flour. So that shouldn't be possible. If you're going to harvest the barley the night before, the Karban HaOmer was brought on the second day of Pesach. So the night after the first day of Pesach, now they don't have 2 days of two Sedarim, they don't have two Seders in Israel. So the first night of Pesach, the afternoon before Pesach, you're busy with your Karban Pesach. That night you have your Seder and you eat from your Karban Pesach. Mm-hmm. The next day is the Yontif of Pesach. It's the first day of Pesach. And you keep the Yontif of Pesach. That night, after Havdalah, it's now Chol HaMoed.
Right.
And those who run the Beis HaMikdash are busy. They go and harvest the barley, which will be brought the next morning.
But that's chametz.
No, no. Grain is not chametz. It can turn into chametz. It can turn into chametz if you mix it with water. But grain in of itself is not chametz. So they would harvest the barley, which will be offered the next morning as the Karban HaOmer. Well, if you just harvested it the night before, that's not nearly enough time for it to dry.
Right.
And there's no sun, it's overnight. So the Pasuk says, again, I'll start from the beginning. Vim takriv minchas bikurim la'Hashem. If you bring a Karban Mincha of your first flower offering to Hashem, that's the Karban HaOmer. Aviv, so Aviv,
springtime,
how do they translate? Is that what they say here? No, they say from ripe ears. Aviv means ripe.
Okay.
It has to be ripe. Kaloi ba'esh, parched over fire. They would actually dry it out using fire. They would put it over a fire, over an open flame, in a container, in a metal container, and they would dry out the barley with fire. So it would not be the natural drying process in the sun, which is the regular way this was done. It was actually roasted over a fire in order to dry it out. Geres, karmel. So geres, as they say, ground. Geres means grind, ground up. Karmel, they translate it as plump kernels. So the geres is different than solas. Solas was the word we had before for fine flour. Fine flour is what you get when you let the grain dry in the sun and then you grind it. That, then you can get solas. Geres is what you get when you take grain and you roast it to get out its moisture and then you ground it up. It doesn't have the same consistency as regular flour. It's a different consistency. It doesn't look the same. It doesn't feel the same. It's a different consistency than typical flour. So that's what you do. You grind it up from plump kernels. Karmel means you don't go find, as you might be tempted to find for yourself, for the Karban HaOmer, some scrawny grain, because that will dry out more quickly. No. You get the best, choicest grain, plump kernels, and then you roast it over the fire, and from there you grind it into this flour that will be used. Takriv es minchas bikurecha. It is from there that you bring the mincha of your first meal offering. V'nasata aleha shemen, you shall put on it oil. V'samta aleha levona, you shall put on it spices. Mincha hi, because it's a mincha. So the Karban HaOmer gets the same treatment as all the other karbanos mincha. It has to have oil and spices. V'iktira koines az karasa, the coin will burn its remembrance. So that's going to be again the kmitza, the handful. Migirsa umishamna, taking from its flour and from its oil. Now we had the same phrase before, but before it was misalto umishamna, from its solas. Here it's not solas, it's not flour that is from dried out grain, natural dried out grain, it's from flour that has been ground up after it was heated over a fire. So that's called geres. So migirsa, from its ground up flour, mishamna, from its oil, al kol levonosa, and with all of its spices, you burn that to Hashem, ishet la Hashem, it is a fire offering for Hashem. So the that is the minchas haomer, which gets its own paragraph over here, because it is its own karban. It's its own karban, a separate karban. So even though the Torah addressed the mincha, the shtei halechem, the two loaves of Shavuos, in the previous paragraph, so the Torah addresses that first, then it addresses the Karban HaOmer. So chronologically in the year, it goes the other way around. You have the HaOmer first, and then you have the shtei halechem. But the shtei halechem is the more elevated Karban. The shtei halechem is wheat, not barley. Wheat is considered better than barley. It is leaven, it is chametz, which is highly unusual in the menachos, so it's considered to be a higher level. And then the Omer is discussed as well. These two karbanos bookend the counting of the Omer. When we count, the Sfiras HaOmer begins with the Karban HaOmer and ends with the karban shtei halechem, the two loaves. So when we count, we start with the second day of Pesach, which is the day that we bring the karban ha'omer. That is not coincidental. It's called Sfiras ha'omer, that's counting right. The omer. We start with the karban ha'omer. The omer is actually a karban that's offered on the second day of Pesach. You count 49 days until Shavuos, and then the day after that, the 50th day, is when you bring the shtei halechem. In a certain sense, the Sfiras ha'omer is counting the progress from the Karban HaOmer to the Shtei HaLechem. That we start with the Omer is matzah, the Omer is barley, the Omer is dried out over a fire, the Omer is the very first harvest, and then 50 days later, presumably we have grown, and now we're offering something which is chametz, something which is wheat, something that has dried out in the normal way, the regular type of flour, fine flour, a very delicious type of bread is offered at the end. So it is a way of representing the growth from Pesach until Shavuos, the Karban HaOmer going all the way up to the Karban Shtei HaLechem. The count is called Sfiras HaOmer. We count for 49 days. Mm-hmm. The Shtei HaLechem is not brought on any of those days. The Shtei HaLechem is brought on the 50th day, the day after we finish the count of the Omer, the 49 days of counting. So that also speaks to the fact that the growth is a growth that starts with the Omer. And that's where we're looking at. We're looking at ourselves growing from what the Omer represents up to what the Shtei HaLechem represent. Obviously, since the Omer is brought on Pesach and the Shtei HaLechem is brought on Shavuos, those two Yomim Tovim, those two holidays, come to represent these two Karbanos, or you can say the two Karbanos represent the holidays. Pesach and the Omer are inextricably tied. Shavuos and the Shtei HaLechem are inextricably tied. And also on Shavuos, we actually bring the Bikurim, the first fruits. Those are also brought on Shavuos, Shavuos being the primary time to bring the Bikurim. So this progress from Pesach until Shavuos is a significant issue. We will, Amir Hashem, I want to say Bli Neder, without a vowel, we will discuss this when we get to Parshas Emor. That's at least in Sefer Vayikra. We don't have to wait until Sefer Bamidbar for this one. And there, where we talk about counting the Omer, so we will discuss, Mirtz Hashem, we'll hopefully remember to do it, we'll discuss these two Karbanos and how they bookend the counting of the Omer along with the Yomim Tovim. See, today, because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, anybody who counts the Omer knows that the two Yomim Tovim of Pesach and Shavuos bookend the counting. But what we fail to think about, unless we're learning it, is that there are also two Karbanos that bookend the counting. And that is the Karban HaOmer and the Shtei HaLechem. So those are mentioned here. Both are considered a Karban Mincha. One is the highly unusual in its bounty, that it's chametz. And the other one is highly unusual in its leanness, in that it's barley, that it's dried over a fire, it's a lower form of a typical mincha. The Karban Omer is a lower form of the typical mincha. The Shtei HaLechem is a higher form of a typical mincha. And so we grow from one to the other. So Mitzvah Hashem, when we get to the Sfiras HaOmer, we will hopefully remember to discuss this in depth.
Yeah. Did they bring the Omer offering every day up until Shavuot?
Mm-mm.
Just that one time.
They would count then afterwards, but the karban was brought once. Just that one time. Yeah. Yeah. There is all kinds of discussion in the Mishnayos about what happens if the field that they're counting on does not produce barley. What about in a Shemitah year where you can't work the ground? So what do you do about the karban ha'omer? These are issues. So there's a discussion in the Gemara in Maseches Menachos and in the Mishnayos over there. Okay. So that concludes the talk, at least for the time being, about Mincha. We will come back to Mincha. All these Karbanos, we've talked about Ola, we've talked about Mincha. We're going to come back to them because the Torah here is only giving us our first look at these Karbanos. In Parsha Tzav, the next Parsha, we're going to come back to most of them. The next section is the Karban Shlamim, the peace offering. That is the next section. I realize that we have time, but I am loath to continue because we are leaving everybody else in the dust. So, with a brand new subject here of the Karban Shlamim, I think it would be appropriate for us to call it an evening, so that way, at least when everybody is back next week, after their unexcused and inexplicable absence, then we'll be able to start fresh with the Karban Shlamim.
Thank you.
I do have a quick question. Is there any relationship between the Karban Mincha and Mincha Davening?
Davening Mincha? That's a good question. It's interesting that the afternoon davening is called Davening Mincha. Really, it's the davening of the afternoon. So it seems that it's called a mincha is an offering. So really, and that's what it literally means. It means an offering. It doesn't mean a grain or meal offering. That's the way it's used in the Torah. But the literal translation is an offering, a gift can be called a mincha. So any davening can really be called a mincha. So the question is, why is this mincha called mincha? Right.
And that was from Yitzchak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Shacharis means morning. Aravis means evening. So mincha, it's funny. We call the davenings morning, gift, and evening. You would think we call it morning, afternoon, evening, or gift, gift, and gift. So it is a good question. Yeah, but I don't have an answer for you off the cuff. It is a good question.
Was there any particular time when people brought their offering?
I don't know. I don't know why it would necessarily be in the afternoon. You know, it's funny. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.